Welcome to Friday and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Happy to have Ijeoma Oluo, local writer, editor-at-large for The Establishment. Hey, Ijeoma.
Hello.
Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, author of While the City Slept. Hi, Eli.
Hey, Bill.
Zeki Hamid, program director at Humanities Washington. Welcome.
Hello and happy Blue Friday.
Seattle's controversial new police station is on hold as of last night. This is the proposed new North Precinct building on 130th and Aurora. Police say their current facilities are cramped and creaky. This one is new and big and $149 million, and critics hate it. Here's a bit of the protest at a city council meeting last month.
There are 125 people downstairs, and they're coming in right now.
Hold up.
Don't make the mistake again of building a building that doesn't allow people.
Well, last night, Mayor Ed Murray announced the building is on hold while the city reviews the plans.
We need to do the work with the community, understand what we do in regards to addressing issues of race in this station or stations, and what we do to bring down the costs.
Race and costs. Ijeoma, this is personal to you. You took your son to a protest against the North Precinct building. What does the city's decision to put it on hold mean to you?
Yeah, I'm incredibly happy. You know, it was really disheartening to be at these protests, to be at these meetings, and see what we all want to see, which is young people fired up and engaged in local politics, which you'd think would take a miracle to get them engaged in local politics. But they were so fired up. This was so important. They were speaking their truth and wonderfully doing so. And then to see, you know, an 8-1 vote to move forward was just heartbreaking. And my sons were heartbroken as well. I brought them to see what local government is like and to see how change can be made. So to be able to tell them last night, especially my 8-year-old who was incredibly emotionally involved in this, that it was put on hold. I mean, you would have thought he won an award. He was jumping up and down. He said, they listened. They finally listened. I didn't think they were going to. So, I mean, I think that a lot of people are kind of feeling that little bit of hope that, you know, it took a while and maybe took a little bit more than it should have, but progress is being made in the fact that the city is actually listening to its constituency.
For those listeners who don't know all the complaints against the proposed North Precinct building, would you summarize those, Ijeoma?
I mean, there's quite a few. The biggest, of course, being the cost, right? It would be one of, if not the most expensive precinct built in the country. And when we have, especially in that area of town where, you know, they're saying they can't afford to put sidewalks up so that kids can safely walk to school, to then turn around and build this giant precinct, it seems like an insult. So the cost when we have rising homelessness, when we have all of these issues that desperately require funding, our schools are underfunded, to then go ahead and build the biggest precinct is an insult. Added to that, of course, the fact that our police are still under federal consent decree and have been dragging their feet, demanding, you know, more money, more, you know, all of these things in order to start treating the citizens the way that they're actually supposed to. The fact that that's been so stalled and such a battle for them to then turn around and say, well, we need this bigger building in order to change the culture of the police was further insult to it. So I think there's a lot of different angles. I think fiscally responsible people found it highly irresponsible. And I think that the entire community of color in the Pacific Northwest found it as an insult as well.
Zeki, the last time you were here, we talked about this and you talked about another funding need in the city, which was you wanted more policing in your neighborhood up nearby, near that, in the North Precinct, right?
Yeah, I live in Shoreline, right around the 99 corridor, and the problems there are many. prostitution, drug dealing, all of that. And the interesting thing is, after last time I was on the show and I went and talked to some of my friends and neighbors, and the one comment, and I've said a lot about the precinct, but the one thing they caught on to was, yes, right on, we need more cops, we need more cops. The way I approach it is, I so desperately want to put my trust in the police. I'm naturally skeptical of police, and I just have this deep desire. I want to trust them. I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. I want to know that they're there for my protection, and you know, to serve these communities. But again and again and again, the system has failed communities of color, and this building sort of represents that failure of the police department to serve communities of color. So, yesterday, I want to say, I was watching the video that you taped, Ijeoma, and through it was about, you know, I really highly recommend everybody go see it. It's on her Twitter account. And it's about 12 minutes long. And for about 10 minutes, I'm going back and forth about, you know, what you were saying until the last bit you said. And that's what really opened my eyes. And you said a lot of these programs between the police and the communities can be done without a building. And this is a much larger issue about systemic racism. And one thing that the Edmonds School District is doing right now, which I think every police department should be doing, is they're working with the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond to have these workshops called Undoing Racism. I think racism is something that we learn and we have to unlearn, undo. I think every police department should engage in these kind of programs, and that's the kind of thing that would prevent the stuff that Ijeoma talked about, what she saw in that precinct when she went there, the stickers, the, you know, anti-Obama stickers and whatnot.
Yeah, we'll talk a bit more about those stickers. Eli, Zeki said that the building represents a failure to serve communities of color. The problem with representing and symbols is that that's a matter of opinion and sentiment. Whether it's right or wrong, well, that's the point. It's a matter of opinion. But how would delaying or stopping a building concretely help anybody of color or not? What's the functional use of delaying or stopping the building?
Well, the building exists now. There is a building. It's just not sufficient to the needs. And I think a lot of people agree with that. Even I think I heard Councilmember Swant say it's not the best building out there. But the question is, do we need to be spending $149 million on a renovation of this building? And should the price tag for the building have exploded from $89 million, which I think it was initially, to close to $150 million? So to me, obviously, no, there we can think of other priorities that we could put that taxpayer money, that city money toward. I do think that it's worth going back in time and looking at how this building came to have some of the features that are being characterized as a bunker or as, you know, interpreted as unnecessary. There's a really interesting Danny Westnik column that came out in August, August 16th. You can go back and look at it. But he points out, you know, one of the perils of what we call the Seattle process, how slow it sometimes is to get things done, is that something can take so long that a different generation of community activists will get involved and be upset about what a previous generation did. And I kind of think that's what happened here. The bunker, its design is in part a response to people who had a lot of input on how it should be more community-centered, more community-friendly, more open, meeting spaces, yoga rooms, skate parks. I mean, this is how...
Which inflates the cost of the building that we're complaining about.
Right. But then, and I don't want to be too stark, I'm sure there's some overlap in the Venn diagram here, but I do think a kind of different, well, first of all, things changed in the country and the culture, I think, in terms of people's sentiment about police, and understandably. And then I think a different generation of community activists came and said they had a totally different feeling about the yoga room and the skate park and the size of the building and so on. And I also think Ijeoma's point is really right on. Aside from the sort of historical and process timeline, the fact, no matter what the origin is, the fact that the building comes before the resolution of the consent decree doesn't feel right. So there's a reason that's happening, you know, step by step wise, but it just feels not quite right.
So in the consent decree, we're expected for the city to be out of that when? That's a matter of years?
Well, as Ijeoma points out, the police have a lot of say in that. The department has not been embracing, you know, a lot of what's coming at it in terms of demands for reform from the federal judge and the Justice Department. So that is up to the police.
Ijeoma, I would have been surprised if a tour of a big city police department didn't find any stickers or post-it notes that were derogatory. But you toured the old facility and saw evidence of an insensitivity among police. Tell us what you saw.
Yeah, I mean, I would say first off, the entire tour felt like an insensitivity. And I think it showed the disconnect between our police force and the people. You know, when you're brought out, they knew that they were having a room full of progressive writers, community activists, even people from the NAACP there. And the first thing they pull out is their riot gear and talk about how they need more storage space for their riot gear. That was the very first thing they brought out. And these things to people of color are, you know, just a sign of a police state and a sign of the militarization of police. And it's a sign of terror for people of color. And to bring that out as the first justification, then we were brought down to the shooting range, which was really traumatic. And I was looking at the faces of the other people of color there, the other black people there, and they had the same look. You know, this is where cops learn to shoot people who look like us.
Since we know cops train themselves to use their weapons, isn't that just a culture clash? You know, yeah, it would be jarring for me to see that too.
Yes, it is. It's a huge culture clash, but I think it also shows the real disconnect between the police and the people. And if they're bringing us here to try and convince us why they need this, it's probably not good to start off with these things and say, well, you know, sometimes we need to shoot people from a further off distance. This shooting range is too short for that. So in order to be better at doing that, we need, you know, a longer shooting range. Right now, we have to drive to practice shooting people at a further range.
But it sounds like you're saying they're not good at PR.
Well, no, I don't even think it's PR. I think it's an understanding of the people, right? Like, I do believe that if you're going to police the citizenry, you have to at least understand where they're coming from. If you can't understand something as basic that being brought to a shooting range is going to terrify people of color, how are you going to understand the actions and statements of people of color when you're interacting with them in the street? And I think that that shows that huge disconnect when we're saying, listen to us, these everyday things are hurting us. And we can't even get as something as simple as, you know, you would think this planned walkthrough that they would think, okay, how are we going to appeal to these people? How are we going to talk to these people? The fact that they can't even then manage to not be, you know, incredibly out of sync with us shows how disconnected. The fact that they would look at that and just see nothing. And then we were taken to the locker room and there were inflammatory stickers on them. One was bend over and then had the Obama logo and the O, which, you know, aside from being inappropriate, it's sexually violent and homophobic as well. And then there was the Calvin and Hobbes sticker peeing on Obama logo as well. And what was interesting about that is, I mean, I don't think there's any office building in Seattle where you could put something like this up in company property and not be sent to HR. Right. It's just not appropriate for any work environment, let alone one that's a state, you know, funded work environment where you're supposed to be interacting with people and you have a reputation for not interacting well with people of color.
Even if there were a President Trump, the Calvin peeing on a Trump logo would be, you'd expect that to be not okay.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I can't imagine. I've worked in corporate jobs all around Seattle. You know, I can't imagine even 10 years ago being able to put anything like that up, like at my cubicle, and not have someone say, Ijoma, that's inappropriate. Take it down. And the fact that that was there, it wasn't shocking, you know, because it confirms what we know of our relationship with the police. But they did two run-throughs of that room before they brought us in to make sure everything was okay. And the fact that no one said, hey, maybe this is going to send the wrong message, was even more shocking. And they didn't even notice it. They didn't even see it.
Well, this precinct building is on hold now. As the mayor says, the city's going to look into the cost, which we discussed. The city's going to look into the social and racial effects of having this building. And so this is something we're going to keep paying attention to. So you're studying. And what are you finding out as you're studying Seattle? And is the building going to go ahead and how? We'll keep following that here on KUOW. And we are going to continue with the Week in Review, birthers and Seahawks and ethical travel. Should you travel over the world just because you can? Stay tuned. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Happy to have Ijeoma Oluo and Eli Sanders and Zeki Hamid with me. Continuing with the news, this morning, Donald Trump reversed himself on the famous birther question and blamed it on Clinton.
Hillary Clinton and her campaign of 2008 started the birther controversy. I finished it. You know what I mean. President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period. Now we all want to get back to making America strong and great again. Thank you.
Offering zero evidence, as usual, Trump said Clinton started the questions about Obama's citizenship when she campaigned against him 8 years ago, but she was too weak to resolve the controversy, and it was Trump who got Obama to finally release his birth certificate. Quick reaction?
Just another incredibly false narrative, and unfortunately, you know, the people we're broadcasting this to are probably not the ones who need their minds cleansed of the Trump untruth, but it's worth restating anyway. It's garbage. I was about to say a word that I can't say on public radio. And to remind, Donald Trump is the person who fanned the flames of the narrative that Obama was some scary other, that he was secretly Muslim, that he wasn't American. And even after President Obama produced his birth certificate, right, this is what Trump is trying to, I think, hint at by saying, I finished it. I got Obama to release his birth certificate. Donald Trump tweeted after Obama released his birth certificate that he had sources that were telling him it wasn't legit. So garbage, garbage, total garbage.
The only evidence, quote unquote, evidence that I could imagine the Trump campaign pointing to is that, remember, 8 years ago, some Clinton aides, as you know, it's a big organization, right? Somebody emailed to somebody, hey, we really should play up Obama's lack of, I think it was like American roots or something. That's the closest I remember to somebody, not Hillary Clinton, but somebody in the campaign saying, people aren't sure about this Barack Hussein guy. Let's lean on that.
Well, Trump frequently mentions Hussein, you know, the middle name, Barack Obama's middle name. And that's, again, it's not really a dog whistle anymore. It's a bullhorn. Eli, you talked about the false equivalency, and there's this almost obsession with fairness right now in media in general. And I think that is leading people to talk about an abnormal candidate as a normal one. And that's really, really dangerous. You have, on one hand, arguably the most qualified presidential candidate in U.S. history. And then you have Donald Trump and the way that it's being portrayed as if they're equal, and they're not. And that's really, really dangerous. This man, I mean, just earlier today I was listening to a segment on KOW, and they said, oh, okay, well, Trump is appearing less racist. How is that okay in 2016 in a presidential election for somebody to be less racist? It should be not racist in any way, shape, or form.
This was President Obama's reaction to Trump's statement.
I'm shocked that a question like that would come up at a time when we got so many other things to do. Well, I'm not that shocked, actually. It's fairly typical.
Obama taking the high road as usual, which made me, when Hillary Clinton made a remark that she said to grossly generalize, you could put half of Trump's supporters in a basket of deplorables. It made me miss Obama because he has resisted deploring Trump has not been his or their supporters has not been his route. He just he rolls his eyes.
But there's a lot of truth to that there's a lot of racists and misogynists and, you know, and xenophobes.
Yeah, but that's not what she said. She said they are irredeemable and that people, human voters, are deplorable, which Obama has stayed away from that kind of language.
Well, I mean, I'll go even further. 100% of Trump supporters are open white supremacists because it's a campaign of open white supremacy. And if you support it, even if you support it for other things, if you say, no, I support it because of the economics, it means you're looking at a campaign of open white supremacy and saying the economics are more important than the safety and well-being of people of color. So, I mean, she was generous. Half, that's really kind. I think the thing we have to remember about Obama is that as a black man, he can't speak out because the moment he says anything, he's the angry black man. And that has stopped him from being able to call out what's been happening, which is open racism against him and his presidency for the last 8 years. And that's what we're seeing now. What we're seeing now is a backlash to that. We're seeing the emboldenment of racists across the country. And he can't say anything. And I wouldn't say that's any sort of grace on his part. I think, if anything, it's allowing more safety and more legitimization to open white supremacy, but it's also the bind that he's placed in that so many people of color in any job are placed in, which is you can't call it out without being written off as angry and violent and the problem.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with this 100%, and thank you for saying that. The restrictions of people of color to react is real. For me, as an Arab from a Muslim background, I am not allowed to be angry in public, because if I am, then everybody points and says, there it is. See, that's what we're talking about right there. I cannot do that. I constantly have to suppress myself. I could never be myself unless I'm home. In the safety of my family. That's just the perception game.
And unfortunately, the only one who is allowed to and really grossly benefits from being angry in this election is Donald Trump. That reads as authoritative, strong, a guy who's willing to shake things up. And it's really, really unfortunate. It makes me worried about the debates, where, you know, on television, a lot of this kind of body language stuff and our latent stereotypes is more powerful than what's said. And I hope that he is not able to get away with just his sort of stream of false consciousness that he is so good at, and his kind of bullying demeanor that sometimes reads to at least, you know, his supporters as admirable.
I may be the only one who makes a distinction between anger and decrying bigotry rather than calling people deplorable. It rings as hate speech. If hate is a synonym for deplore, then it seems like hate speech. But I'll accept that. I also want to know what you think of the all the pneumonia health stuff. Does it already feel like this is going to be forgotten? Because it sure seemed like a big deal for the first half of the week.
It might, because Trump will say something incredibly, you know, stupid or something next week, and maybe people will start forgetting about that. But there's something here I want to mention. There's something called the Jill Robinson effect, which is...
There's also the Jill Stein effect.
Yes.
There is that too, but it's completely different. No, the Jill Robinson effect is after Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson had to be the greatest baseball player in order for him to be taken seriously. He had to be better than every other white dude on the field in order to do that. And I think that we're seeing that with Hillary Clinton and this whole pneumonia thing, because the story for me is she powered through, because that's what women do. They just power through these things, because anytime...
What do men do?
We just sit home and complain.
You do?
Yeah. Okay. One man that doesn't sit home and act like he's dying when there's a cold. I know I do it.
Okay.
But she powers through, and she has to do that, because otherwise she'll be perceived as weak. So that's the Jill Robinson effect right there. She has to be more qualified, stronger, more powerful than any other candidate in order to make it and be taken seriously. So we have that false equivalency on display here.
And it's going to keep coming up throughout the election in different forms for a couple of reasons. One is definitely, you know, the fact that we expect, well, I think there's the expectation that women are too frail for this job. And so anything that feeds into that narrative is going to be exploited. Right. A man can get sick and they're like, oh, he'll be fine. You know, it happens to all of us. But if a woman does it, see, I told you, she can't handle it. She's too weak. I also think we have to be really aware of the inherent ableism of this discussion at all. And the fact that your physical stature would preclude you from being able to hold this office. We have had
That's a good point.
Plenty of, you know, people holding this office and holding very important positions who had different illnesses, different disabilities, and they did fine so long as it wasn't affecting their mental capacity. And to sit here every time and think that a president looks a certain way and that comes with a certain body, I think does a disservice to people all across the country who have bodies and health systems that fall outside of those norms and are incredibly capable and could be incredibly accomplished if we didn't have this bias. This bias feeds throughout all business. And anyone who moves up in the business world, they have to hide every illness, every perceived physical weakness. They have to hide it because it's seen as a moral failure and as an intellectual failure when it is in no way connected. And I think that we need to be more aware of how these discussions hurt people around the country.
Yeah, a friend of mine said, could we have a one-arm president? Because my uncle has one arm and he's tough as nails and capable in all the other ways that you need to be capable. Okay, let's pause there on Trump. Does everyone want to talk more about Donald Trump?
No.
Or less?
Less. Okay. But I did want to say what Ajoma was saying made me think we've also had presidents who, because they could stand up and walk around and kind of seemingly get through the day, were able to squelch very legitimate concerns about their mental capacity, like mm-hmm. Reagan. So it kind of goes the other way also. And the basket of deplorables, it reminds me a lot of what Obama said in the campaign at a fundraiser, same scenario
yeah.
about people who cling to their guns
yes.
and their religion.
The difference was he said that they were bitter and cling to their guns and religion, which I took as an understanding, empathetic way to criticize.
No,
and there's
I'm
a right lot to criticize.
That. Well, I guess what I'm saying is, I hear your critique of what Clinton said, but if you just turn the dial a notch and depersonalize it, what their speech, their ideology, their action makes up a basket of deplorable things. I mean,
yes.
just depersonalize
deplorable
it slightly.
Deplorable things, right. That's just how it hit. I'm not saying that's how it should have hit you. That was my reaction
and,
to calling
but,
people.
But I guess it's unfortunate that we focused more on the personal attack or the perceived personal attack than the legitimacy of what she's saying about ideas, actions, policy.
We're not focusing on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really frustrating as a person of color to see all this outrage about her calling a spade when our safety is being threatened. You know, people, it is more offensive to call out someone's actions as deplorable.
I don't. Is anyone saying that?
Oh yeah.
Is anyone saying her basket of deplorables comment was more offensive than racism and xenophobia? And
it's getting a heck of a lot more focus.
Yeah. That's the media. But let's distinguish between the media and real human beings, because the media thirsts for a campaign.
Hey, we're
twist
real human
story.
Beings, Bill.
Yeah, these are comments.
I'm in the media.
These are comments I get every day.
Yeah.
Anytime I call this out, people are like, "Oh, use softer language. Be nicer. Mm. You're not going to get anywhere being this hard with the open white supremacists who want to take away your rights and, you know, and oppress people of color." I hear it all the time. I mean, the top priority is white comfort over brown safety.
I appreciate that. Not here, and that's why we like to have you guys come on the Week in Review, which is going to continue in a moment. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Eli Sanders and Zeki Hamid and Ijeoma Oluo. This week, the Seattle Seahawks joined the national debate over police, race, and the national anthem. This started when a San Francisco NFL quarterback, Colin Kaepernick, sat and then knelt instead of standing while the anthem was played before games. He said he was protesting racial inequities and police violence toward black men. Some other NFL players and high school players and Seattle soccer star Megan Rapinoe and others have been kneeling in solidarity. But in their game on Sunday, Seahawks players and coaches linked arms and stood during the anthem in what they called a display of unity. Critics of that move include Dr. Jason Johnson, who wrote at the website The Root and said the Seahawks stand was cowardly and confusing.
If someone wants to take a stand against police brutality, if someone wants to stand in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick, that's fine. And if a team or individuals on that team decide that they want to put their hands on their heart for the pledge or something else like that, then that is fine. But you don't want to take the mushy middle where you basically don't make any statement. And that, unfortunately, is what the Seattle Seahawks did yesterday. They neither stood against police brutality, nor did they stand in support of anything that was important. They did something in the mushy middle, and in the end, it was both confusing and really a diminishment of the key issues that started this kind of protest.
Zeki, what did you like about the Seahawks locking arms on Sunday?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. First of all, it pains me to my core to say something nice about a 49ers player, but Colin Kaepernick has conducted himself with such grace and courage, it's really amazing. If for the casual observer, you watch the Sunday game, you see that, yeah, absolutely, I can see how you can say it's a cop-out, they did nothing. However, there's a story behind it. And what they're doing as a team, I mean, they had the hashtag building a bridge and all that. They're actually doing something. They're scheduling meetings with police chiefs across the state. They're scheduling a meeting with the mayor of Seattle. They want to be people who facilitate that kind of conversation with people all across the state. And that, I think, takes it a step beyond the protest. And I think that's a really, really positive thing. I don't know if it's ever been done before. I know there are individual players who have done that, but I've never seen an entire team facilitate these kind of conversations with people in government and police chiefs. I think that's really remarkable.
Eli, I know you're not a sports fan, but I know you know that the Seahawks have a lot of fans and a lot of attention. What do you want to see from the team, if anything? And the Mariners, I suppose.
Well, you're right. I don't pay a lot of attention to the Seahawks, and I don't take my political cues from multimillion-dollar earning sports figures generally. But I do think there's a big opportunity here. The Seahawks have express this idea of kind of going on a listening tour, you know, to catch up on what's going on and what a lot of activists are like way ahead of them on. So you have Seahawks that listen to the show, right?
I'm sure.
The whole team every
yes.
week?
Every week. Yes. They never miss it.
So attention Seattle Seahawks, here is something you can do. Right now in this state, in Olympia, there is a commission that is studying our law on police killings. Washington State has a law about police killings that is an outlier nationally. It makes it virtually impossible to charge a police officer who has unjustifiably taken the life of a citizen. This law is unusual, and a lot of people think it needs to change. There's actually a statewide initiative that people are collecting signatures for, but most likely the legislature is going to have to act. This commission that is studying this law has one more meeting, and then it has to make a report to the governor. So, Seahawks, on your listening tour, figure out when the next meeting of this commission is, get yourselves down to Olympia, and say something about this law, because I guarantee you, changing this law has a hard road ahead of it in the state capitol, but one thing that could change conservative lawmakers' minds is a bunch of football players coming in and saying, this law needs to change, listen to us.
Igioma, there may or may not be a lack of unity among the Seahawks regarding this law or any law. They were locking arms and saying they were displaying unity, whatever that means. What do you want to see from the Seahawks?
You know, honestly, what I would like to see, and it would be lovely is if as an organization they started looking at this closely. I, too, was disappointed from the display that they put on. The reason why I was disappointed is because a few different players on the team had expressed their desire to take a knee. And I think that deciding this was more of a PR move to kind of prevent individual players from speaking their minds on this issue and taking the action they wanted to take. I would like to see, because I think what we need to remember is, you know, the majority of NFL players are African American. These are black men who, outside of uniform, are the most at risk from police brutality. I would like to see them being able to speak their own minds to their own personal experience and then have the team management listen to them. And that means that not everyone is going to agree. But I think that, you know, when we had a whole week of a couple of different players saying that they were going to join this protest, they were going to take a knee, and then to suddenly be like, no, we're going to, as a team, we're all going to stand. It really felt like what sports teams often do, which is kind of silence dissent under the guise of, you know, of being a team player. And I would really like to actually hear these young black men speak their truth and be heard by their leadership instead of saying, we all have to agree, we all have to be at the same place, and we're going to take this safe middle road.
Well, are you sure they weren't heard by their leadership, but then told to be unified on the field?
Yeah, you know, and they may well have been. And I think that that also is a problem, right? I think that you're not heard if you're heard and then dismissed and said, okay, well, that's great. Now you're going to act this way.
Well, it was September 11th and making any, whatever flag reaction would have been, making it riskier. And we get to see what they're going to do this Sunday and the next and the next and on this listening tour of police stations.
Exactly. It's all about follow through. And that's what they said. It's about follow through. I'm really excited to see what they're doing. At Humanities Washington, actually, we've been having these discussions about race for the past 2.5 years. So if anybody from the Seahawks wants to join us in these conversations, we're doing them all throughout the fall, throughout the state. So Richard Sherman, if you're listening, would love to have you.
Oh, he's listening. Okay, so yeah, we'll see. I think I'm going to be at the Mariners game because I'm a fair weather fan tonight. So we'll see what the Mariners do and high school players tonight and the Seahawks and Megan Rapinoe and all. And we'll watch it on KUOW's Week in Review. Back in just a moment. We'll be right back. This is KUOW's Week in Review. Zeki Hamid is with Humanities Washington, Eli Sanders with The Stranger, Ijeoma Oluo with The Establishment, and I'm Bill Radke, hitting the top stories of the week and trying to figure out what they mean. For example, now that you can cruise from Alaska to New York, should you? The biggest cruise ship to ever sail the Northwest Passage docked in New York City today thanks to global warming that has melted the northern sea ice. Zeki, when you fly back to your native Jordan, your jet spews carbon into the atmosphere. Is it more unethical for a KUOW listener to cruise from Alaska to New York City?
It is, absolutely, because the destruction or global warming wreaking havoc in our way of life should not be fodder for really rich people to have a good time. The reason that the Northwest Passage is open should be so incredibly alarming to us, not as an opportunity to go, hey, that's great. Let's go see some polar bears. I want to see something that nobody else has seen before. It is just simply morally reprehensible.
Well, we're mixing a lot of different things, right? There's carbon. There's the fact that the tourists are rich.
There's sewage, being spewed into the open sea. I mean, there's a lot there. There's nothing good about taking a cruise in the Northwest Passage. There is simply nothing good that could ever come out of this. It is bad in every single way. I cannot believe that we think this is okay.
Yeah. Ijeoma, I don't know whether you're laughing or crying.
I mean, this is just some Mr. Burns stuff where you're like, yay, it's fine.
So is it about that? Is it about this? The ice has already melted, but you should be feeling bad, not partying? Is that?
No, well, I mean, we certainly shouldn't be taking advantage of it to add more to it. And it does. It's not as if these ships are, have no carbon footprint and are just, being oared all the way through, right? They're furthermore destroying the environment that's already been destroyed enough to allow them through.
So then it's about carbon. So it's like, I just want to know what the rule is. We shouldn't be flying.
I love this idea that if you're rich or anyone and you want to go through the Northwest Passage, you just act like a Viking and row your way through.
Yeah, exactly.
Fine.
Yeah, what about an electric vehicle to Northern Canada? That's okay?
It depends on where the electricity comes from. Uh-huh. My beef with this is it costs $20,000 per ticket, right? Did I understand that right for the Northwest Passage?
Something like that.
So it's just a gross misallocation of resources.
So it's money you could be giving to charity.
You could buy some carbon offsets or something. If you're rich enough to throw $20,000 down a toilet that flushes into the Arctic Ocean, maybe you could use that $20,000 to, buy a carbon offset or buy yourself a Tesla.
Are any of you cruisers? Do you even love cruising anyway?
I would never be caught dead on a cruise.
Okay. So there's nothing at stake for us who aren't really interested in cruising
Do any of us at this table have $20,000 for a ticket?
No.
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 So there's really nothing at stake.
Right. And we haven't even talked about the tourists who visit the villages along the way in Greenland and Alaska and Canada. This is a nice summary of the ethical dilemma from University of British Columbia political science professor Michael Byers.
You have 1,000 of the wealthiest people on Earth descending on communities of some of the poorest, most disadvantaged people on Earth. They suffer from one of the highest suicide rates in the world. They suffer from endemic diseases like tuberculosis that are not common in developed countries, but here they are in northern Canada. They're under enormous pressure in terms of unemployment, in terms of housing. And then all of a sudden, 1,000 people who could, for all basic purposes, come from another planet descend upon them. And the gap between these two groups is so large that it's impossible to imagine a very positive outcome. Now, these indigenous peoples, many of them will tell you that they want to have this kind of cruise ship tourism because it brings some money to their communities. And they're right, it does bring some money. But the question is whether the social upheaval is worth that small benefit or whether there are better ways of bringing development to the Arctic.
Now, he didn't say what the better ways of bringing development are. It sounds like he wants to somehow bring in money and jobs and medical care and maybe mental health counseling, which hasn't happened, but yet not change the culture. Their culture needs to stay unchanged, even though no culture stays unchanged.
You can do that. You can bring resources into community and not change it dramatically.
But it hasn't been done.
But you can.
So what's the connection between cruising and the goal of helping people who live in these faraway places?
I mean, there is no connection. Yeah. They're incredibly far away. I think we have to stop acting like the touch of rich Western civilization is going to fix anything. If anything that's been proven throughout world history is that we pretty much destroy any culture that we come into contact with. And in fact, a lot of the indigenous societies up in the north are suffering due to the fact that, you know, they were doing okay and then Canada landed on them and then has proceeded to let them languish in this system that they did not build. And to act like suddenly rich tourists are going to be able to do anything that the Canadian government couldn't do and should have been doing a long time. I mean, they have been so far behind the curve in recognizing the rising suicide rates in these territories, recognizing the missing, murdered indigenous women in these areas. You know, tourists are not going to be able to fix any of that. And to have, you know, to say otherwise, it's just, I think, absolving the government of responsibility for what they have done in these areas. And it also feeds into our hubris to believe that we benefit anyone when the truth is that we treat the rest of the world like it's our own personal toy and it's our own personal vacation spot. And we can eat, pray, love through the world and become enlightened and have these wonderful moments. And none of it's true because we weave this huge path of destruction.
So since every place you travel has been changed by travel, Manhattan is no longer a settlement of indigenous people, and neither is Seattle. How long do we have to wait before we can travel without guilt?
I'm not sure you can, I guess. but I mean, look, this is more about the destruction of life as we know it, for me at least. This is what this is really all about. That the Northwest Passage being open right now for travel is a symptom that life as we know it is going to end at some point. The planet's not going to die. The planet will always be fine. It's humanity that's going to die. We should not be just celebrating that by taking a $20,000 cruise and you know, again,
humanity and beluga whales and polar bears just and narwhals and
yeah, we're literally things. Partying on the grave yeah. of the planet. It's just and I think there's a difference between being invited and encroaching on someone. And, you know, there are plenty of tourist spots set up that are set up by the people there in their own best interests or in their, you know, in their own desires.
So then do we have to figure out what their best interests are? Because when the mayor, I've read interviews with the mayor of this village says, oh, this is great. And, you know, and a dancer says, I'm so proud to be showing my art. And I don't know whether they're telling the truth or whether they know what's best for them. But am I supposed to try to figure that out on their behalf? Feels a little bit patronizing.
You know, I don't think that we should be saying, you know, don't go to anywhere because, we know better than you that you don't need us here, you don't want us here. But I do think that when we have a culture in dire straits who is desperate for any sort of income coming into there, to then take advantage of it because we've also managed to ruin the environment, which, by the way, further hampers their ability to have any income, right? When you're rapidly changing environments, you're changing fishing, you're changing all these things that people depend upon, and then say, oh, well, yeah, you need us now because, you know, don't you see you're going to, and yeah, of course, people are going to take that money. I think that, you know, just first off, you know, the fact that, no, we should never be glad that there's such an environmental disaster that it now opens up places to us that, you know, we shouldn't be able to go into that. I think that first off should be enough to stop anyone from wanting to take this. But I think second of all, we should look at economic need versus economic desire. And those are two separate things.
We've got to move on because we've got time for one more story as we wrap up the week in review. Back in just a moment. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle needs some adult supervision, so said a Federal Way Republican this week after the Seattle City Council said it's considering easing up on homeless people camping on public property. State Senator Mark Melosha, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You want a statewide law that would prevent Seattle, for example, from giving campers more time and services before evicting them from public property. Why are you proposing this?
What I'm proposing is that Seattle, you know, I hate to say this, ban all the unauthorized and illegal encampments. They clean them up, and they move people into only authorized encampments. And this is by July 1st of next year.
What would make a camping site authorized?
Well, we'll be setting up minimum standards for this. As you know, there's been a lot of legislation where we have minimum standards for tent cities. We've been trying to pass that at the state level. Well, also, we need the same thing for all encampments. There'll be state minimum standards, public health and safety standards for all authorized encampments.
Okay, so you're not saying no tent cities, no encampments. If campers have nowhere else to go, though, how does moving them solve anything? You want to get people into shelters and housing, right?
Exactly. Well, the first step, like I said, is getting them out of the illegal and unauthorized encampments, getting them to only authorized. So Seattle should be putting its resources, time, and money into that. And then the next step, obviously, is get them into real housing. And what is the most efficient, effective way to do that? And, of course, they recently passed a $290 million housing levy. Their budgets have increased by 40% in the last few years. I intend to help them with state funds, increase state funds for housing. But they have to do it a correct manner, and it means following the law and cracking down on all the ills that are affecting, in fact, destroying neighborhoods and businesses in Seattle.
Senator Melosha, typically Republicans like local governments to have local control. Why block Seattle with a blanket state standard?
No, I said minimum standards, like a minimum standard for a minimum wage or minimum health and safety standards. There is plenty of standards set by Olympia on health, safety, and labor laws. Obviously, most people who I've been talking to, especially in Seattle, believe we need some minimum standards, so they're doing this correctly. I think it's obvious to everybody that what has been happening has been kind of a unmitigated management disaster, the way we're addressing sweeps and getting people into treatment and getting them to success.
Senator Melosha, this is Eli Sanders from The Stranger. It's really easy to talk about getting tough and creating new standards and so on. It's harder to find money in Olympia. How much money will you commit right now to demanding to help Seattle with its homelessness problem?
Well, assuming Seattle starts obeying the law and actually managing things correctly, I'm looking at, first guess, $30 million in increased funding just for this alone. And that's not counting increased funding for mental health or substance abuse treatment. But again, cracking down, asking people to follow the law basic management competence isn't cracking down. Is the federal government cracking down on Western State Hospital when they demanded that that hospital meet minimum public safety standards? I mean, of course not. That's just good stewardship. And unless you think Obama administration just actually wants to punish Jay Inslee, of course not. They're doing their job.
You talked about Seattle needing adult supervision. Isn't that a little rich coming from someone in Olympia?
No, I mean, you talk about
minimum standards. The state Supreme Court has set for years a standard that you and your colleagues have failed to meet for funding basic education, for funding a minimum standard that we provide under our Constitution an adequate education for every citizen of the state. You failed to do that, you and your colleagues in the Senate.
Well,
there are a lot of people who think you could
use
adult supervision on that.
How you contribute to the world's ills. But let's just talk about what's going on in Seattle with the way it's handling the drug and safety issues and where people are dying. Somebody in Seattle, I give Ed Murray a lot of credit for admitting there are serious problems and nobody's managing anything. So I think you yourself have to take credit for your part in making sure things are falling apart in Seattle. And it's not just me saying that. Just listen to your own citizens.
Senator, we'll wrap up here. For those listeners who don't know about this, the city of Seattle is considering requiring a 30-day notice to residents before an unauthorized encampment could be cleared. Unless it's unsafe or unsuitable, they'd have to give only 2 days' notice in that case, but still have to offer residents somewhere else to go. So are you promising that the state will contribute enough money that Seattle has enough shelter beds where residents are willing to go because they can deal with they're not night shift workers, they can deal with the hours restrictions or the restrictions on being with their mate or their pets. Will you get everybody into shelter who wants to be?
Well, that is the goal, but I guess we should find out where is the city of Seattle and where is King County spending the money effectively right now. Nobody is identifying that and actually ask them to come up with a real plan. I mean, I hate to say President Bush seemed like a fantastic manager the way he handled Katrina compared to the way city of Seattle is handling this crisis. This emergency has been going on since November. We're still passing reports and plans back and forth. It's time to stop this Seattle inaction, the Seattle process, and actually get something done.
Well, as you say, the Seattle process, the mayor is talking about doing a lot of things, thinning the homeless industrial complex, and now there's a sort of a homelessness czar in the city. I mean, this is a hard problem. It's going to take a lot of time, right?
No. I mean, it depends what your definition of emergency is. This crisis has been developing, the opioid, for example, for about 7-8 years now. Everybody saw this coming. We have to have better management of all our human service programs, so we're reacting quickly. But the bottom line is we have to work on getting results, and that means making sure we have the right accountability and performance systems in place, the competent people running things.
State Senator Mark Melosha, Republican of Federal Way, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
On KUOW's Week in Review with Eli Sanders and Zeki Hamid and Ijeoma Oluo. Any more reaction to that?
I think we need to remember that homeless people themselves are not the problem and they are not illegal. They are human beings. And we need to stop treating them like they're garbage in the street. These are people. And people are being made increasingly homeless in the city every single day. And we need to start looking at them as our neighbors instead of problems to fix. And we need to realize that we are the problem with our lack of infrastructure and our lack of resources, and that's where we should be putting our attention.
Zeki, we have a minute left.
One thing I want to say is that sowing the seeds of division between Seattle and the rest of the state is not constructive in any way, shape, or form. Stop trashing Seattle. For Seattle people, stop trashing the East Side. This is one state.
And I stand by my statement that the Republican Senate, including Senator Melosha, could use adult supervision.
Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, author of While the City Slept. Zeki Hamid, program director at Humanities Washington. Ijeoma Oluo, local writer, editor-at-large for The Establishment. Thanks for joining us this week, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in, and get the Week in Review and all of KUOW's podcasts at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.